Thank you, Richard. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'll talk a little bit about BSA and who we are before I get started, just for those of you who may not be familiar. As Richard said, I head up BSA, the Software Alliance, and we represent software companies around the world. So big software companies and a number of small software companies. And Adobe is one of our very valued members. And Richard, in 2018, will be the chair of our strategic planning committee inside of BSA. So thank you, Richard, for taking that on for us. And thank you for the invitation to be here today. We, at BSA, we do a number of things. So one of the things that we do is we run a compliance and enforcement program that encourages, through various means, companies to use software within the terms of their license. And that we operate that in about 60 countries around the world. And we've done a lot of work over the last few years in terms of honing the message there. So by that, there are a couple of things that I would point out. One is I have attempted, to the extent possible, to expunge the term piracy from the vocabulary of BSA. And that's because what we do, mostly, is work with companies that have over-deployed their software or have fewer licenses than they should have. But in my mind, most of those are not pirates, and so therefore we don't deal very much with people that are engaged in sort of commercial for-profit distribution of illegal goods. We deal with companies who have a business doing something else and in the course of happenings have ended up being under-licensed. The other thing that we have done a lot in the last couple of years is really focus on cybersecurity. So one of the things that we have found is that often companies are under license because they themselves are not fully aware of what they have on their networks. And beyond the fact that that causes licensing issues, it's a big cybersecurity risk to not be aware of what you have on your network. We did a survey last year, and one of the things that we found is that if you ask the CIO or the CTO inside of a company, they estimate that about 20% of their employees have put things on the network without their knowing. So that's pretty high for a CIO to estimate. But we also asked the employees of companies, and almost 50% of the employees said that they were putting things on the network without their CIO or CTO's knowledge. So there's also a very significant gap there in terms of what CIOs think is happening inside the companies and what is actually happening inside the companies. And that causes licensing issues, but it causes big cybersecurity issues as well. The other thing that we do is that we work on policy issues around the world. We work on a range of policy issues, but I'm going to talk today mostly about issues that have to do with data. Part of the reason that I took this job is because the software industry is going through two enormous transformations at the same time. And one of those is that many software companies are becoming data companies as much as they are anything else. They are not consumer-facing, ad-driven data companies in the way that a Google or a Facebook is, but they are data storage, data management, data analytics is very much either the current business or the future business of many of the companies I represent. So our policy agenda has changed pretty dramatically over the last few years as we have focused more and more on issues around data, including privacy and artificial intelligence, which were two I thought I'd talk about a little bit today. And I want to talk about those because data has also become such a big asset to the entertainment industry. Many of the studios are working with the companies that I represent, like IBM and others, on using predictive analytics for making creative decisions or marketing. There's obviously been a lot written about what Netflix and Amazon are doing with data. Netflix announced that they're spending, I think, $7 billion on content in 2018, and a lot of what they are doing is using data to drive how they're optimizing their marketing and to make sure that they're delivering as good a product as they possibly can. So data, and therefore the policy issues around it, like data ownership, data access, data privacy, artificial intelligence, are really issues now for the entertainment industry as well. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about those. Just briefly about me, so I am very pleased to be the CEO of BSA, the Software Alliance. I'm also the president of our new foundation, which I'll talk about a little bit as well. Before I was in this job, as Richard said, I had the great pleasure and honor of working for President Obama and being the first intellectual property enforcement coordinator, which was a tremendous honor, and had many good things about it, including the opportunity to work with Paul Rosen, who I think you heard from earlier today, and who was a great friend and colleague inside the administration. Before I was at the White House, I did a brief stint as a law professor teaching international trade and intellectual property. And before that, I was the chief trade negotiator at USTR. While I was at USTR, I started the Intellectual Property and Innovation Office there, which was also a fantastic place to be. So that's a little bit about me and what brought me to this moment. As I was coming here, I was thinking, you know, about the fact that this is the last trip that I'm scheduled to take in 2017. We'll see if that holds true, but it is scheduled to be the last trip I take in 2017. And I was thinking about 2017 and the year that it has been. And there are a number of things, I think, that stand out for me in 2017. And the two things that I'm going to mention are not actually particularly happy things. So I think this is a year where there has been increasing distrust of government and institutions. And that's something that's been happening for a while, but I think it's something that has increased even more this year. And it has been a year of enormous political change, not just in the United States, but around the world. Distrust of government and institutions is something that I find very personally concerning, perhaps because I spent a good deal of my career in public service, and I believe in government and what it can do. And so the fact that Americans now are at nearly record lows in terms of their trust in the government and their trust that the government will do the right thing, I think is deeply concerning. So Pew has been doing this research, I think, since the mid-50s. And in the mid-50s, in 1958, when they started, 75% of the American public expected that the government would generally do the right thing. And that started to decline in the 60s, so this is not, you know, this is not something that's happened overnight. It started to go up again in mid-80s and in the late 90s, basically in times when the economy was doing well. There was a bit of a peak right after 9/11, but shortly after that, trust started to deteriorate, and it's never really come back from that, and it has declined even more precipitously in the last few years. And so now we are at a point where only 20% of Americans trust that the government will do the right thing. And that is a real problem for us as a country and a nation, and something that I find very concerning. At the same time, I think looking around the world, we've seen a rise of supranationalism. We've seen real pushback against globalization in a global world. And again, this is not something that just happened in 2017, but 2017, I think, has been striking to me in how many places around the world that has been happening. So, you know, there's obviously a new president in the United States who is much less globally focused than his predecessors have been. But then, you know, looking at Europe, you see in Germany, Angela Merkel won, but for the first time since World War II, there are right-wing nationalists back in the German parliament, and her attempts to build a coalition have been struggling. So that is so Germany is still more politically fragmented than it has been for a while. In the UK, they obviously have the Brexit negotiations going on, which is which is a sign that the European experiment is potentially starting to fray around the edges a little bit. And even inside the UK, Theresa May called for a vote. She performed very poorly in that vote, and now she's been in the position of having to form essentially a type of coalition with a very right-wing nationalist Irish party called the Democratic Unionist Party. In Catalan and Spain, we've seen the referendums and the votes around splitting Catalan off. So in Europe, that has definitely been something that we've seen over and over in 2017. In Asia, I think there is less political fragmentation, but still a great deal of instability. So obviously, North Korea is enormously unstable and a threat to the world as a whole. If you look at the major Asian economies, I think many of them have less of the political splintering that we're feeling in the Europe and the United States, but we're still seeing some of the same themes and certainly a great deal of change. So South Korea has a new administration because President Park was impeached on corruption charges. Abe in Japan won his election, but has his support has been declining over the years. In India, under Modi, we have very strong, again, sort of nationalist-oriented leader, although with less of the fragmentation, the division that we've seen in the United States. And in China, you have a China that is more economically stable than it was 2 years ago, and increasingly politically powerful and politically centered, and coming out of the Congress Party in October, Xi Jinping is stronger than ever and clearly, I think, looking to see where he can expand his global influence and whether or not there's a vacuum in leadership that China can step into. So it's been not just in the United States, a really extraordinary year in terms of political change and unrest around the world. You know, going back to what BSA does, you know, we work with governments around the world, and part of what we do is try to explain what the software industry is, what we're building, why we do it. And there are, both with the Trump administration and with other governments around the world, some really interesting and important policy discussions that are coming out of that. And again, as I said, I'm going to focus today on data and some of the things that are happening around data, because I think this also is already going to is already and will have a big impact on the entertainment industry. So I talked a little bit about predictive analytics and how those are already being used, you know, very much by some players in the entertainment industry, but increasingly by every player in the entertainment industry. Obviously, the idea of using data and information to make decisions is not a new one, right? That's something human beings have been doing ever since they had information and the ability to make decisions. But what has changed really dramatically over the last decade is the amount of data that exists in recorded form and the ability to use it. So, you know, one fact that I think is always kind of staggering is that if you sort of stand here today and you had every piece of data that has been recorded from this moment back to the beginning of human history when we first started recording information, 98% of that was recorded in the last 2 years. So the amount of data that is being generated and then is being recorded is exploding in a way that is not even captured by the word exponential. And that is going to have an enormous impact on our economy, it already is, and on our society and how we live our lives. And so part of what we do at BSA and part of what our companies do is not just drive that change, but also think about what are the impacts that it's going to have and what do we need to do to make sure that we are prepared for them as we can be. I think artificial intelligence is a perfect example of that. So the phrase artificial intelligence can definitely create concerns. It can create images of, you know, machines that are taking over jobs or robots that are going to take over the world and, you know, be the decision makers for the human race. You know, my own view is that those concerns are extremely unlikely to come to pass, I'll say. Very few AI systems operate independently of human decision making. All of them are built by human beings with parameters being set. So yes, absolutely, as AI systems are being built, the human beings that are building them need to be very conscious of what they're building, including making sure that the data that they are putting into them is as unbiased as possible. But there is an incredible potential to use AI in cybersecurity and healthcare to broaden access and inclusion in all sorts of ways. And I think what is really important is that when we are at this moment, which is still very early in the technology, that we all are sort of collectively conscious of what the benefits could be and then are pushing towards that. I'll talk a little bit more about AI in a moment if people are interested in kind of what the burgeoning AI policy issues are. But just to go back to data more generally, one of the things that's really important if anyone in this room is going to be able to use data effectively is for data to be able to move around the world. Because almost very few of us, and certainly not the people in this room, are going to be able to work with data effectively if they are working with data that is confined to a particular geography or a particular country. So the ability to be able to work with data that is coming from all over the world is extremely important. I don't know. I'd actually be really interested in learning more about how data and AI, which is used for threat prediction in a lot of different scenarios, how that's being used for content protection. It's not a conversation that I've had, but my strong assumption is that people are, if they're not already doing it, are already thinking a lot about how to do it, because I think there's a lot of potential there. But it's only going to work if you can actually, again, be using data from around the world. And right now, there's no consensus among governments that having data being able to move freely around the world is the default rule. There's actually a wide variety of views on there, and there are a lot of governments around the world for various reasons who are working really hard to try to keep as much data inside their own countries as possible and not let it leave. And so one of the issues that BSA works on in a variety of ways, including in the NAFTA negotiations that are going on now, is trying to set a rule that says, mostly, under most circumstances, data should be able to move around the world freely. But that is not a simple position, although it's simple to say. It is actually fairly controversial, and there are a lot of governments that would disagree with that. To me, it feels a lot like intellectual property and services in the late 80s, when it was very clear, I think, at least to some, that the intellectual property was going to be a major driver of the U.S. economy. It was going to be a major driver of the global economy, but there were no enforceable international rules on intellectual property. And it took the leadership of the United States and a few other countries to use the Uruguay round and the beginning of the WTO to set up rules on intellectual property that most governments that belong to the WTO would have to abide by. And we're kind of at that moment for data now. I think most people are seeing that this is not going away. It's already very important to the U.S. economy. It is already important to the global economy. That level of importance is only going to grow, but there's no international consensus around it. And so that is a real deficiency in our international system and one that needs to be addressed. And so potentially NAFTA is one of the places where it could start to be addressed. NAFTA is obviously only an agreement among the United States, Canada, and Mexico, but if those three trading partners can come together and agree on a rule that starts to set a precedent and an example for other governments around the world. There are other things that we're trying to get done in NAFTA. One of them pertains to AI and trying to set a rule that algorithms that our companies use and that your companies use can't be forced to be disclosed to another government. There are already some rules like that for source code, but there are no rules around disclosure of algorithms, and that is starting to be a big problem for us and for others. There are concerns, and I think understandable concerns, really, about how decisions are being made by artificial intelligence. Unfortunately, one of the solutions to that that regulators are coming up with is, well, if you give the algorithms to us, then we will have confidence in the decisions that are being made. And I think that's, I don't want to say a fool's errand, but I think that's an inappropriate approach for a couple of reasons. One is, I don't think it will actually be particularly helpful to the regulators, although they may think it will be, both because algorithms are not necessarily the best way to make a determination about decision making, but more importantly, because really what the regulators and policymakers care about is trying to make sure that decisions are made that they think are appropriate. And so I think that is where policy should focus, rather than on a disclosure requirement that algorithms be turned over to governments. Instead, I think governments should be focusing on what they think the appropriate outcomes are, and then trying to push towards those. The other AI policy issues that are going on right now, and some of this is happening in the United States, but much of it is happening in Europe, are around who owns the data that is coming out of AI. There's even some conversation in Europe about having a compulsory license for data, which is a term borrowed from the IP world. and one that I think would be really detrimental if it was put in place in Europe. And then there's a lot of conversation about jobs and the impact on jobs, which I'll touch on in a little bit. I'm running low on time, so just very briefly on privacy. So as I talked about data moving back and forth, very, very important. The United States and Europe have some difference of view. There is a agreement between the United States and Europe called the Privacy Shield that is in place right now but is under threat. And so there are various litigations that are going on that are challenging it, and BSA is part of that litigation and trying to make the case for why it is important that these stay in place. There's a European regulation called the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, that is coming into effect later on in 2018. And so there's a lot of work going on inside of U.S. companies and European companies getting ready for the GDPR. So most of the privacy policy and privacy regulation that we're seeing around the world right now is happening in Europe. And that is part of the reason that I and the team spent a fair amount of time in Europe, is because not just because Europe is obviously an important market, but also because what is happening in Europe and what happens in Brussels is spreading to other parts of the world, either because countries are looking to Europe as an example, but also because the European Commission is being very intentional about going out and selling its vision of data privacy around the world. And so that is, Europe is a concern, not just because of what's happening in Europe, but also because of the precedential value of it. Let me talk briefly about jobs and workforce development. You know, we in the software industry, we create a lot of jobs, as the entertainment industry does. We create right now, today, 10 million jobs in the United States. And actually for us, that number would be higher if we could fill all the jobs that we have. So one of the problems that we have is that we have more jobs than we can fill. And part of the answer to that is trying to make sure not only that our young people are being educated and getting the skills that they need, but also that we're trying to help retrain people and reskill people that are interested in having tech jobs, but don't have the skills and the training that they need in order to do that. We recently launched a foundation out of BSA, and I'll say another thank you to Adobe here, because Adobe is one of the founding members of the foundation. And the foundation gives us the ability to step back and think about a number of these issues. So part of what we're doing through the foundation, which is called software.org, is education on emerging tech. You know, what is AI? What is blockchain? What is 3D printing? What is quantum? And what are the societal and economic impacts that those technologies are going to have? Part of what we're working on is diversity in tech, which is a big issue, diversity of all kinds, gender diversity, racial diversity, economic opportunity for all. And part of what we're working on is jobs and workforce development and trying to make sure, as I said, that young people across every part of the United States are getting the education that they need, and that people who are in the workforce already that want to be reskilled or retrained have the ability to do that. So that's actually just a fraction of our policy agenda for next year, but I'm going to stop there, in part because I see that I'm running low on time. You know, I think 2017 was a challenging year for sure. I think 2018 is probably going to be as well. You know, part of that is trying to ensure that software continues to be seen as a force for good, which I think it is, but there is a lot of skepticism right now around tech and what is coming from tech, and much of that does not come from the companies that I represent, but it impacts them as well. So that is you know, something that I think I'm going to be thinking about far into 2018. And part of it is also, how do we counter the impulse to turn inward that we're seeing around the world? And I think both of the two things that I just said, I think a lot of it, they come from fear of change and fear of what lies ahead. And yet, you know, I think we live in a pretty incredible time. But part of the reason that there is fear is because I think for most of human history, it was relatively easy to look back a decade or two or three decades and imagine what the next two or three decades would look like. It was pretty easy to look back and then extrapolate to the future. And today, that is not really possible. And so, on the one hand, I think that means that our possibilities are almost limitless. But with that uncertainty about what the future will bring comes fear. And so, you know, part of what we can do through BSA is try to educate people, try to understand and give them credible, reliable information about at least what we think will happen. I think there are also some really important issues that need to be addressed. I mentioned one briefly. I think diversity in the workplace, in the tech industry, and beyond is incredibly important, and I could go on about that at length, but I won't. And the second thing is what I started talking about. I think the level of distrust that Americans have in their government and their institutions is going to have long-reaching, far-reaching destabilizing forces unless we can turn that around. And one of the things that I'm very hopeful for is that actually technology can be part of that, can be part of trying to rebuild that trust in governments. But that is going to be a long process, and that's really going to need to be something that everyone is working on. Clearly, government has a lot to do there. I think companies have a lot to do in terms of rebuilding or maintaining the trust that they have with their customers. And as I said, hopefully technology and software solutions can be part of trying to help rebuild those connections between governments and their citizens. So with that, I will pause. Thank you so much again to Richard and to the Content Protection Summit for having me here today. I know I have run through most of my time. I'm happy to take a question or two if there are questions. But thank you so much for having me here. It was really a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Victoria. All right. Any questions? No questions. Don't be shy. I can run pretty fast. We got one over here.
Okay, not that fast.
So give us an idea of where what we call Hollywood, or let's just call it content, and business software connects. Where are we aligned? Where are we different? Where could we work more closely together to achieve the goals that you just outlined?
So I think data policy is a place where we should be aligned. I mean, that's partly why I focus on it so much. I think, you know, we like to say that every sector is a software sector. Every sector is using data, and while we are sort of spending, you know, every day, day in and day out, thinking about data policy issues, I think the entertainment industry should be doing the same, because the same concerns that we have are going to impact you and your ability to use data. I mean, at essence, the reason that we care about data is not because our companies use it. It's not because how Adobe is using data. It's because our companies, it's the customers of our companies. So our companies are building the things that entertainment and finances and agriculture and manufacturing and healthcare and energy use. And so if we lose on these data policy issues, it's our customers that are going to be impacted. It's the entertainment industry's ability to use it that is going to be impacted. So I would make a pitch strongly for the entertainment industry to also start paying more and more attention to these data policy issues and working with them on that. You know, I think, so I'll leave with that.
Any other questions? We've got a question over here for Victoria.
Hi, I'm Lulu Zaitza from One Simple. I have a question about free movement of data, and I'm trying to help people figure out how to deal with GDPR and not moving the data. What is BSA doing about the fact that the rules, part of the reason Europe is looking at restricting the movement of data is because the rules about securing the data and the use of the data and the laws about that are not equal in different countries and in different locations, in particular between the EU and the US. Is BSA trying to address that? Because until there's more homogeneity between the laws protecting the data, it's hard to have it traveling freely around.
So we are not trying to get the United States to harmonize its rules with Europe. And we're not trying to get any government to adopt the European system. I think what we're trying to do is to demonstrate to Europe and others that while the United States may have a different system, for that matter, Japan, India, Brazil have different systems, that doesn't mean that privacy isn't adequately protected, and that doesn't mean, therefore, that data shouldn't be able to move back and forth. So as a concrete example of that, we were very involved in the negotiations between the United States and Europe on the Privacy Shield. Obviously, U.S. privacy law did not change. There were some things that the Obama administration did and have remained in place to make our system slightly create more opportunities for Europeans to bring complaints in United States venues if they wanted to. But fundamentally, the law didn't change, nor do we feel that it necessarily needs to change. I think what we feel very strongly is that if you have governments that have, like I believe the United States does, a high level of privacy protection, that even if it is not identical to the way that Europe has set up its system, that that should not be a reason that data can't move backward and forward. And so what you need is a rule that says that is the default rule. If you are at a high level of protection as the United States and as Europe are, as different as our systems are, that data should be able to move back and forth. That is a long way of saying I think governments should recognize and be able to work together even if their privacy systems are different one from another, as the United States and Europe are different one from another. But certainly Europe is out there pushing an alternative view of that, which is that everyone should adopt the European privacy system.
Excellent. Hi, I'm over here, sorry. thank you so much. I know you have a prior commitment, and I know you've got to run, but so appreciate you taking the time, coming and updating the crowd. Ladies and gentlemen, Victoria Espinel, BSA, the Software Alliance. Thank you. Thank you, Victoria. Okay.